Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
In this cautionary tale, all the little pigs build houses of straw. That's just one of the scathing criticisms from a new report from the House of Representatives on the government's response to Hurricane Katrina. In addition to this 600-page report, which will be officially released on Wednesday, two others, one from the Government Accountability Office and another from the Homeland Security Department's Office of Inspector General, were released today, showing that the Federal Emergency Management Agency wasted millions of dollars in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. All of these reports showing government waste and ineptitude have Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff in the hot seat. Today, Chertoff held a press conference and announced a series of reforms. Linda Feldman is a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. She joins us now. And Linda, can you describe some of the reforms that Secretary Chertoff has proposed?
Well, he would like to hire up to 1,500 new full-time employees as year-round disaster coordinators. He wants to create a database of pre-approved contracting firms for removal of debris and cleanup. He wants reconnaissance teams to report disaster conditions to the Homeland Security Department and the FEMA Operations Centers within hours.
Yeah, it was surprising that previous to that, I guess one of the suggestions is to send FEMA employees to emergency shelters to register victims for aid instead of relying on the victims to register by phone or internet. It's so surprising that that was how the system was set up.
Exactly. I mean, when you see what they're saying is needed, it really is shocking to think how ill-prepared we have been, and that we, you know, I guess ignorance is bliss. We didn't know how unprepared we were, but I guess we discovered that during Katrina.
But the other thing that's suggested is that trucks be tracked, trucks that carry food, water, ice, blankets, that they be tracked by satellite.
That's right. I mean, we can all remember the stories about trucks of ice that were meant to be sent to the Gulf Coast that wound up, you know, driving around the country and, you know, in Maine and in other, you know, completely almost random places because they, you know, there was just such a shocking lack of coordination with relief supplies.
Well, Chertoff's press conference today comes on the heels of a damning report by the House Homeland Security Committee. The report indicts all federal agencies for failing to act to protect Americans, but it really singles Michael Chertoff out, saying that he acted either late, ineffectively, or not at all. Now, the committee that issued this report is dominated by Republicans. Given that political makeup, were you surprised at how strong the criticism was?
I was quite surprised, and I think the Democrats were surprised, too. There were no Democrats on the committee, although some Democrats did take part in the deliberations, but they didn't sign off on the report. And I guess, in a way, the Republicans have called the Democrats bluff. They're showing that they can be tougher than anyone expected against members of their own party.
Well, and is there any talk of Michael Chertoff resigning over these reports?
You know, I haven't heard anything along those lines. The president is famously loyal to his appointees, and you know, Michael Chertoff is coming out today with these recommended changes, as is Francis Townsend, who's the White House Homeland Security Director. I think he's trying to get ahead of the train and really look forward. The White House keeps talking about how we don't want to focus on the past, we want to focus on the future. Chertoff clearly knows he's in trouble and that changes are needed, not just to protect his own skin, but for the sake of the nation.
And Linda, we have about a minute left. What kind of fallout do you think this will be for the White House?
Well, the White House is, this is, you know, Homeland Security is their number one campaign issue. They say that, you know, the public trusts them more than the Democrats to keep the nation safe, both against terrorism and against natural disasters. And now we're getting this renewed focus on how badly handled Katrina was. And so this is really their political neck is on the line.
Linda Feldman, a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. She joins us from her office in Washington, D.C. Linda, thanks so much.
Great. Thank you.
The first government witness is back on the stand as the fraud and conspiracy trial of former Enron executives Kenneth Lay and Jeffrey Skilling enters its second week in Houston. Mark Koenig is one of 16 ex-Enron executives who've pled guilty and are cooperating with federal prosecutors in their case against Skilling and Lay. But the defense is using an unusual argument, telling the jury that Koenig and the others lied when they admitted to crimes at Enron. John Emschweiler is covering the trial for The Wall Street Journal. He joins us from federal court in Houston. And John, remind us, what are Lay and Skilling charged with?
Well, they're charged with basically leading a widespread conspiracy to hide Enron's financial problems and then lie about the condition of the company to the public, particularly in the years 2000 and 2001, leading up to the December 2001 bankruptcy.
And what role did Mark Koenig play? And he has pled guilty to a role.
Yes, he's pled guilty to aiding and abetting securities fraud, which is he's basically pled guilty to taking part in this alleged conspiracy. Koenig was the head of investor relations. He was the guy who went and talked to Wall Street analysts, to the big-time institutional investors, and answered questions and, of course, sold the Enron story to the street.
Now, there's been this fascinating back and forth between Mark Koenig and Lay and Skilling's defense team. Koenig, as we said, has said he's guilty. He's repeated he's guilty. But Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling and their lawyers say, no, you're not. It's kind of odd, isn't it, to see people on trial say someone who's already claimed he's guilty, tell him you're not guilty.
It is odd, and it's an unusual defense to basically say that, you know, that no crimes were committed, despite the fact, you know, you have more than a dozen of your former colleagues saying we committed crimes. Some of the other trials, like Ebbers at WorldCom and Richard Scrushy, the former head of HealthSouth, they basically acknowledged that there had been big crimes at the company. They just said, we didn't know about it. It was done by underlings who hid it from us. They're basically saying the defense is that except for a few isolated crimes that don't really matter, and they were pulled off by the former chief financial officer, Andy Fastow, there were no crimes at Enron. So in other words, all these people, these 16 you mentioned who pled guilty, essentially pled guilty to crimes that didn't exist, according to the defense.
And why would the defense say that these people would do that? Why would they plead guilty if they're not guilty?
The crush of probably the biggest government, you know, corporate crime investigation in history, they say, essentially forced these people to admit to things they didn't do because, one, they couldn't afford to defend themselves adequately against the juggernaut, and two, under current federal sentencing guidelines, if you're convicted of multiple crimes at trial, you can go to prison for many, many years, and that these people are making sort of, in the defense's mind, a pact with the devil in hopes of cutting that prison time down substantially.
Well, in the meantime, Mark Koenig has responded to that. He said, no, I'm really guilty. So what's the line of questioning being directed at him on the stand? What is he saying?
Well, they have that line that you mentioned there, you know, are you really guilty? Yes, I am. Well, no, you're not. But they're also then sort of the other line of questioning is, well, you know, you didn't really understand the full scope of Enron's complexity, all the accounting decisions that went into some of the things you say were wrong, all the legal reviews that went on. So partly they're saying, you know, you're saying all this under pressure, but and then you also don't really have a full understanding. And if you did, you'd understand, too, that everything was okay.
John Emschweiler, which side of this story, I'm guilty, I'm not guilty, which one, can you get a sense, which one is resonating with the jury?
It's really hard to tell, of course. And they seem attentive, they seem quite attentive during the direct, which was the first line of questioning by the government. But they also seem to be paying attention to the cross-examination by Mr. Skilling's lead attorney, Dan Petrocelli, and now by Mr. Lay's lead attorney, Mike Ramsey. So, you know, just from the attentive level, I think they're still very much sort of, you know, trying to make up their minds. I think both sides scored some points in this early, you know, sort of rounds, but, you know, it's so early. We've got a trial that may last 4 months or more, and a lot of witnesses to come that it's hard to, you know what they'll even remember about the first witness 4 months from now.
And the juries are also getting to see tapes. Tell us about these videos of Lay and Skilling.
Yeah, there's been some contention between the two sides of lawyers on this. The government, in their direct examination, Mr. Koenig, showed them snippets of tapes of, you know, analyst meetings that Enron held and all-employee meetings where Mr. Lay and Mr. Skilling spoke and allegedly told lies to various constituencies of the public. The defense came back and said, no, you have to show the entire tapes, which some of which were an hour or more each, and in order to get the full flavor and understanding of Enron and the men's actions. So the judge has allowed them to play these tapes. He says they're going to only do it once in their entirety, but it has slowed things down considerably because, you know, we're looking at 6 to 8 hours of tapes. Then you start questioning each of the tapes. So it's been kind of a chess match in that sense of who's going to control the pace of the early trial. The defense generally wants to get as much of their case and their story into the government's prosecution as possible before they get around to their side.
Do you think that these tapes are backfiring? I mean, as you said, the prosecutors hoped that they would show Lay and Skilling lying about the health of the company. But in their total, we understand that they also show them being, you know, fawned upon and adored by the people they're speaking to.
Well, they're being, yeah, it's often being fawned upon by the analyst community, the supposedly hard-eyed analysts. But there's also, you know, there is certainly, they give a sense more of the more complexity of Enron, and that might help the government, but might help the defense, excuse me. But it's also, you hear Lay and Skilling saying all these glowing things about Enron and some, you know, extremely powerful adjectives. And, you know, you look back on it now and you realize they're making these golden statements only months before the company collapses into bankruptcy. So a juror might wonder, well, what's going on there? You know, did they really not understand the condition and the risks the company was facing? Or are they telling us untruths when they're making all these glowing statements? Obviously, if they make the latter conclusion, that's not good for the defense.
Well, the government's next witness is expected to be Kenneth Rice, a close ally of Skilling and the former head of Enron's broadband unit. He's also cooperating with the government. He also pled guilty. It would seem that that's the government's strategy, just to continue to parade these former Enron execs before the jury.
Yeah, they're going to have a number of Enron execs, you know, capped off by Andy Fasto, the CFO at some point, and Ben Glisson, the treasurer, who were very senior people in the finance end and presumably know as well as anyone the secrets of Enron's financial activities. They may also bring out at some point a guy who was the co-defendant of Skilling and Lay up until just weeks ago, Richard Causey, the former chief accounting officer, reached a plea bargain in late December. And though he's not yet on the witness list, he could be added, and he could also be a very powerful witness against the defendant.
John Emschweiler is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He's covering the Enron trial in Houston. And, John, I'm just wondering, you know, the east coast of the country is, you know, covered in snow. The rest of the country is talking today about Dick Cheney's hunting accident. How big is this trial in Houston? Has it calmed down a little? Are people in it for the long run? Or is it still sort of a daily front page thing?
Well, the Houston Chronicle, the newspaper, is treating it as a big ongoing story that usually gets front-page treatment and, you know, multiple stories, and they have their blogs up. The crowds at the trial have, you know, certainly quieted down from the first day or two, so it's no longer, you know, a packed courtroom. And I suspect it'll stay that way until you start getting, you know, a big-name witness like Fasto. And then eventually, you know, Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling have said they're going to testify, which I assume that'll draw quite a large crowd.
John Emschweiler in Houston, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Sure, my pleasure.
And take a second for this reminder. As always, we welcome your thoughts on anything on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from. Still ahead, Dick Cheney's hunting accident. And a group of evangelical ministers says global warming is real. God has made them stewards of the earth, and they are morally obligated to do something about it. Much more coming up here and now. Hear from a new voice on the offensive against global warming. A group of 86 evangelical leaders, including the presidents of 39 colleges, pastors of megachurches, and prominent authors, have released a statement urging others to not only take note of climate change, but to take action. Joining us on the line is Reverend Dr. Daniel Mercado, senior pastor at Gateway Cathedral in Staten Island. He signed the evangelical petition. Welcome, Reverend Dr. Mercado.
Thank you for calling.
And those who have signed the petition write that there was a time that they needed considerable convincing, some of them, that global warming existed, but now they've seen and heard enough. What was the tipping point for many of these people who signed the petition?
Well, I think, first of all, it needs to be stated that evangelicals have been concerned about this issue for many, many years. We've discussed this at our meetings for years, and I think what happened was we finally came to a point where we said we need to begin to form a consensus. And I think our statement, what we believe is our statement represents the beginnings, at least the beginnings of a consensus within the evangelical community for strong action on global warming and many other environmental issues.
In fact, the statement says that evidence gathered since 1995 has only strengthened the conclusion that climate change is happening and is being caused mainly by human activities. And the report also points out that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the world's most authoritative body on global warming, was chaired by a devout evangelical.
Yes, evangelicals have been involved in this for a long time. Some of us have been a little slow to speak out about it. But I know consistently in my church here over the past 41 years that I've been a pastor here, I have almost on a regular basis yearly designated times that I have spoken about this issue and told our people that we need to be better informed.
That's the first claim of the paper, that it does exist. There are three other claims, including that global warming will hit the poor the hardest and that this is a moral issue. Why is it a moral issue involving Christian moral convictions?
We are called as Christians, well, we're called as mankind, to be good stewards of God's creation. How much more as evangelical, Bible-believing Christians, when we read that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, when we read that he created these things, when we read that he gave Adam the commission to watch over them and be a good steward of them. I think from that standpoint, we have a biblical mandate as well as citizens, you know, to see for generations ahead. We have a mandate that we love God and we want to obey him. We love others and we want to make it as good as possible, especially for those, like you mentioned, the poor.
Well, in fact, the fourth claim of the petition is a call for action on the part of governments, businesses, churches, individuals. For instance, in the U.S., the most important immediate step that can be taken at the federal level is to pass and implement national legislation requiring sufficient economy-wide reductions in carbon dioxide emission. That's what the petition calls for. But as you probably know, the Bush administration has been against some of these mandatory curbs, saying they'll harm the economy. And not all evangelicals are in on this, as you well know. On February 2nd, when the National Association met, they could not come up with a consensus on global warming. What do you say to that, to other evangelicals? I'm thinking of James Dobson, Chuck Colson, Richard Roberts of Oral Roberts University, who all signed a letter saying, in fact, they disagree with the group that signed your petition.
Attitude is a very important thing, how we respond to something like that, because we're in agreement with these men on many other issues. We're looking to begin to form a consensus within the evangelical community. We believe action needs to be taken. We haven't taken any positions on particular legislation, but in 2004 reporters, we state the 2005 G8 summit, the Bush administration acknowledged the reality of climate change and the likelihood that some human activity was the cause, at least for some of it. And I think that's why the president took the initiative of the Advanced Energy Initiative. As helpful as it goes, it calls for research, and I think that's important. What we're calling for is not only research, but when we get the research, to do something about it.
Well, and as you know, the Bush administration has not signed the Kyoto Accords and has not said that, in fact, there's enough scientific evidence now that global warming exists.
Well, I wouldn't say that altogether. I'm not going to defend the president, but he has the Advanced Energy Initiative, and they are working on it. And just like evangelicals took so long to come to this point, I think we need to keep encouraging the government. I think what we have done through this initiative hopefully will help the president to realize that there are a large group of evangelical Christians who believe that this is time to begin to not only think about this, research, but begin to take some action.
Another criticism is interesting to us because you're also being criticized for claiming to be on the side of God. The conservative Boston Herald, which is here in Boston, editorialized that your movement is trying to make policy into a religious crusade, implying that those who don't agree with you are sinners. This is their words. And the paper also says there's also not a word in the initiative about the cost of the solutions and the possibility that a warmer earth will bring benefits to some regions and people. That seems to indicate that you got an uphill battle here.
we're not making the statement that everybody who disagrees with us is of the devil or not of God. In fact, our polling shows that 66% of evangelicals would support legislation that cost anywhere from $15 a month to $20 a month. I wouldn't have signed a document that I thought would be divisive. No. I thought, by signing the document, I was saying, in I think a very, very fine way and a very gentle way in that sense, though it's some strong statements in there, wake up. Evangelical Church, we've been commissioned by God to be good stewards of the earth. We've let other people run this environmentalist movement. And I don't think we're in agreement with a lot of the things in the environmentalist movement. But we do agree that something has to begin to happen, at least from our standpoint at Evangelicals, that we need to get on this bandwagon and say, let's look at some of the things that are going on right now and how they can change and how it can affect the climate and how it can affect our environment.
The Reverend Daniel Mercado, senior pastor at the Gateway Cathedral in Staten Island, New York, also one of the 86 evangelicals who signed the Evangelical Climate Initiative, Climate Change, and Evangelical Call to Action. Reverend, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for calling.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from W. Beanie's. 78-year-old hunting partner is in stable condition today after the vice president accidentally shot him while hunting this weekend. Harry Whittington was hunting quail with Cheney and another man this weekend at the Armstrong Ranch near Corpus Christi, Texas. Whittington apparently got hit by birdshot when he unexpectedly came up behind the vice president, who was shooting at a covey of quail. Well, for more on this story, Michael Cranish of the Boston Globe joins us. And Michael, can you tell us how Mr. Whittington is doing today?
From what we understand, Mr. Whittington is in stable condition. He was kept overnight in the intensive care unit at a Corpus Christi, Texas hospital. So far, he's not talked to the press. There's a statement on the wires this morning saying that he so far would decline to do so. Obviously, the press is going to be staking out the hospital and very interested to see how he is. But we're told through the various spokespersons that he's in stable condition, and we'll just have to see if he comes out and talks to us.
Such an odd story. The ranch owner, Catherine Armstrong, was the first to report the accident to the media. Apparently she was on the scene. What does she say happened?
She spoke to the Associated Press and some other media, and what happened was that Dick Cheney was on this hunting trip with his friend Harry Whittington, an Austin, Texas lawyer, and Mr. Cheney accidentally shot Mr. Whittington at around 5:30 on Saturday. The local paper, the Corpus Christi Caller Times, put out the story on its website at about 1:30 on Sunday, and then the White House confirmed it. So it's about 20 hours or so later, and the White House confirmed this by responding to a media report. So obviously the media, including myself, have asked the White House, why didn't you put this information out yourself?
Well, and, you know, why is that important to you?
Well, it's not every day that the Vice President of the United States accidentally shoots someone. This is, rather, big news. It was on the front page of most newspapers, including the Boston Globe. It's the kind of thing that you would want to put out. I can't imagine a White House not releasing this information. So obviously the question is raised, would they have released this if the media hadn't reported it? How seriously they consider it? Anything involving the president or the vice president or senior staff, things like that, I think it's obvious to most people it's the kind of thing that you would want to put out. It would come out eventually. It seems like it's inevitable, so I'm not sure what was gained by waiting those 20 hours.
We're wondering, too, if the question's being raised. Mr. Whittington is an older man, and apparently he mistakenly walked into Mr. Cheney's line of fire without announcing he was there. He sort of didn't follow, apparently, some hunting protocol. And so the question is raised that, is the vice president in a dangerous situation with guns? I mean, the headline could potentially have been the other way around, that somebody shot the vice president.
Seems like an excellent question to me. You know, if you're a Major League Baseball player, you're not supposed to go riding motorcycles at 80 miles an hour. So you have to ask, is this the kind of thing that it's worth putting the president or vice president in? I can't speak for them, but I can imagine that they would respond, since they're avid hunters, that they follow the safety rules, that it's a safe sport, relatively speaking, and that they feel comfortable doing it. The president of the United States goes bicycle riding. He's had accidents. He's fallen. He's been bruised and so forth. So you know, there's a certain amount of risk that they feel is acceptable to them. Other people, you can imagine, you know, someone who's a physician saying, you know, gee, I wish you wouldn't do that, but, you know, they feel that it's okay. That's another question that presumably they'd be asked, but obviously they know that there is a certain amount of risk involved with all sorts of activities.
We should point out, too, that the vice president, because of heart problems and probably because he's also the vice president, travels with a medical team, which quickly jumped in and aided Mr. Whittington.
That's right. The vice president, the president, they always travel with medical staff. I've traveled numerous times with president and vice president, and there's a whole assortment of staff with them, and I've been on trips, in fact, when journalists have gotten ill and the staff has attended to them, so that's quite common.
The Internet is also buzzing with this story, and it's not the first time there's been stories raised about Dick Cheney's hunting trips.
Well, that's right. A year or so ago, Dick Cheney went on a hunting trip with Antonin Scalia, the Supreme Court Justice. Of course, as a Supreme Court Justice, Scalia has to rule on cases that are brought by or directly affect the administration. So there were questions raised then, and Scalia, you know, wrote a lengthy memorandum in which he defended his actions. But you know, certainly this is part of who Dick Cheney is. It's part of who President Bush is. Bush owns a ranch in Texas, and he goes hunting. It's just part of their makeup, and I'd be surprised if this would stop either one of them from going hunting again.
Well, I was going to say, do you think one of the things to come out of this will be that Dick Cheney might not be able to find any hunting partners, because every time he goes, seems like something happens?
Well, I'm sure he's gone on a lot of trips that we don't know about. You know, unlike the president, who's every moment, you know, basically we're told about in some way, we don't know as many things about what the vice president does. Sometimes we hear later, he went here, he went there, he went to an undisclosed location, quote-unquote, at certain times. So we don't, you know, his travels aren't as closely followed. The press doesn't automatically get to go with him. Unlike with the president, if the president goes anywhere, even if it's just a vacation for 24 hours, there's some members of the press that basically are assigned to follow him on a rotating basis. Not the same for Cheney. The press doesn't get to follow him all the time, so we don't always know what he does until afterwards, and sometimes not at all.
Yeah. Michael Cranish, reporter for the Boston Globe in Washington. Do you think anything serious will come out of this? I mean, any policy change, any reaction?
Well, you know, hunting safety is always a serious issue, and looking at the websites of the Texas Parks Department and Wildlife Department yesterday for the story, I saw that there were reports about hunting accidents, and they've gone down, and that there are all sorts of measures taken. It's obviously very serious. There are fatalities every year on hunting accidents, so it's certainly something that should be taken seriously. Every time there's an accident, whether it's a plane accident, a car accident, a hunting accident, it gets in the news, and then people think about it again. I know as a reporter, I've written stories about accidental deaths over the period of time, and whenever there's publicity about it, sometimes the family members will come out and say, this is very difficult for us, but the reason I want to talk about it is that I hope that news about this will help other people act more safely or more consciously of the safety problems. So at least for a short period of time, you'd think that this will prompt new reviews of safety.
You know, it occurs to us that the headline today could have been different in another way. It could have been Vice President Dick Cheney kills a man in a hunting accident.
Well, I asked this question of the White House about, you know, how serious this is, and they pointed out that it was with pellets, birdshot, and so forth. But you know, who knows? Certainly, you know, if it had been higher up or gotten into someone's eye, it'd be that much more serious. So certainly they are looking at how serious it is and thankful that they believe it's not as serious as it could have been.
Michael Cranish, thanks very much.
Thank you, Robin.
And on the Winter Olympics front, don't listen if you don't want to know, but here are some updates. American gold medal contender downhill skier Lindsay Kildow managed to escape serious injury in a frightening freefall crash during a training run today. Kildow crashed moments after defending Olympic downhill champ Carol Montelet-Carl of France was hurt in a spectacular fall. Officials say Carl suffered rib and back trauma. Kildow will remain hospitalized as a precaution. In the biathlon, Russia took the gold and silver in the 15-kilometer individual race. The favorite, Germany, fizzled. Here's the medal total so far. Norway has 8, the U.S. 5, including a gold and silver in women's snowboarding today. Russia also has 5 medals, Germany 3, the Netherlands a total of 3. For those rooting for the hometown team, the U.S. leads with the most gold medals, 3. Of course, we think they're all winners. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Well, in the spirit of the upcoming Valentine's Day, we thought we'd speak with psychiatrist Scott Holtzman. His new book is called The Secrets of Happily Married Men. And instead of telling men to get in touch with their emotions, he tells them to treat their marriages like a job and their wives like a client. Scott, do you really tell this to your patients?
Well, it's interesting because when women hear that advice, they immediately cringe and go, oh, no, that's not the way to make marriages work. But when I tell that to men, they get it. They recognize that what they've been told over the years has been, you know, get in touch with your emotions, be more like a woman. But what's worked for them in other aspects of their lives, applying good strategies to getting the job done, if they know that they can use that same go-get-em attitude at home in their marriage, they feel empowered and not useless.
Give us some examples of how you might do that. Let's say someone is going to approach their marriage as they would a job and their wife as a client. What would they do?
What I suggest to men is they make a job description, and that job description might include things like honor, love, and cherish, or it might include treat her special. Then when you've got a list of what your job descriptions are, you know whether you're on track or not.
So you're saying that in a male mind, having it in that form as sort of a to-do list registers more than someone just saying, be nice to your wife.
Exactly. When men hear, be nice to my wife, they say, but I am being nice. I don't understand what you mean by that. So I ask men to objectify it a little bit. And remember, men will walk around with their Palm Pilots, or they'll have the Blackberries. I mean, they've got lots of things to remind them of all the tasks they have to do during the day. And I say, use those same skills and apply them to your marriage.
But doesn't it denigrate a marriage a little bit to think of it as, a list of tasks?
Is that how you're feeling, Robin?
Shall I recline here on my chair and we can talk more?
You know, what denigrates marriage is the feeling that you just can't get anything right. And to get home day after day as a husband and get the message from your wife that you're just not meeting my standards. And unfortunately, statistics show that women are much more likely to lodge complaints about the relationship, and they keep trying to communicate to men through emotion-based language. I think what's a real shame is that so many marriages fall apart because men feel incompetent.
How much do you think that these behaviors are learned, and reinforced by society, and how much is hardwired from the caveman times?
There are clear and distinct differences in the brain, and you see some of those differences from the very first day of life. For instance, a girl will be more prone to make eye contact, whereas a boy may be just as equally attracted to a geometric object as he is a face. But there are also social influences that play a role, particularly when it comes to boys being able to express their emotion. Boys are being told, get out there and don't cry, shake it off, keep moving. One of the things that I say in the therapy that I do is, at this point, it doesn't much matter why it is that you may not be able to access your emotion as well as your wife. The bottom line is, we can still make this relationship great, even though you may not turn into Alan Alda.
Another thing that you recommend that men do is collect data on their wives, observe them, and take notes.
Well, why not? When we feel overwhelmed, the part of our brain, the thinking part of our brain, the cortex, starts to shut down. And the amygdala, the reptile part of our brain, starts to kick in. So what I think both men and women need to get away from that fundamental feeling of anger and frustration that gets in the way of making a relationship good. And one of the ways to do that is by gathering information and knowledge.
I'm still thinking about the fact that we have a reptile part of our brain. The amygdala?
Well, the amygdala and what's called the limbic system is very primitive, and it's the part of your brain that is geared so that you can recognize trouble and get out as soon as possible. Mm. The problem is, when that part of the brain kicks in, the frontal lobes, or the thinking part of the brain, shuts down, and you can't solve problems. Mm-hmm. So one of the chapters in the book is on how to deal with conflict and how to use your relaxation skills and your thinking skills to get out of those conflict moments and come back to the thinking part of your brain and resolve problems.
Scott Holtzman is a psychiatrist and author of the book, The Secrets of Happily Married Men. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Gatto Barbieri's music from Bernardo Bertolucci's X-rated film Last Tango in Paris. Critic Pauline Kael said it was the most erotic film ever made. But if sadomasochism and murder aren't your cup of tea, we have some other suggestions for Valentine's Eve. But beware, as your mother always told you, sex and love are not the same thing. And that's reinforced in the new book, The X List, the National Society of Film Critics' Guide to Movies That Turn Us On. Joe Morgenstern of The Wall Street Journal and Peter Rayner of the Christian Science Monitor are two of the contributors. And Peter, let's start with you. Does contributing to a book like this reveal a little bit more about the reviewers involved than they might be used to?
There's no way that you can not write about films that turn you on without getting personal on some level. Of course, what turns one person on doesn't necessarily turn the other person on. And in some cases, some of the contributors to the book are turned on more by camera moves than, you know, people moves. But, you know, it's a very personal thing, and I think that's what's good about the book is that it sort of reinforces the idea that critics are not these sort of lordly people speaking objectively about something, but actually write from their own experience and their own desires and their own hang-ups.
Well, Peter, you picked a film by a director that many people may not have heard of, Japan's Konichikawa. It's 1983's The Makioka Sisters. Let's just listen for a few seconds.
店に来るお客にこんなこと聞いたな。芸者が胸鼻につけたら唇を唾で濡らさんようにいつも気つけてるそうや。物を食べるとき、かて唇に触らんように箸で口の真ん中へ持っていかんな。Well,
obviously, it may not be the translation that is turning you on, Peter. What turned you on about that film?
It's one of the most, or maybe for me, the most sensual movie ever made. The texture of the movie, the skin tones, the fleshiness of it, just everything together is such a tactile experience, you know, on top of which it's an amazing piece of drama. And I think it's a film that sort of needed to be rescued on some level from obscurity. I'm turned on by the technique of this film in a way that's more than just academic.
On the other hand, Joe Morgenstern, you wrote about a film that had Brad Pitt's flesh but didn't have much else.
Well, I mean, in a sense, my piece is a downer because it's about the misuse of stars. You know, Brad Pitt is a certified movie star. But Troy, his support troops weren't there for him. They don't know how to make him look good. The director and the hapless screenwriter allowed Brad Pitt to be upstaged in a crucial scene in Achilles' tent by Peter O'Toole, of all people.
You really think death frightens me now? I watched my eldest son die, watched you drag his body behind your chariot. Give him back to me. He deserves the honor of a proper burial, you know that. Give him to me.
He killed my cousin.
He thought it was you.
Peter Rayner, who are some of the directors that all critics agree just know how to have some sort of sensuality in their films? I mean, there are a few that had some repeat appearances in the book.
Well, I don't think all critics agree on anything.
That's true.
Least of all sex. But, I mean, a lot of people have sort of come around to Bertolucci. I know that when Last Tango in Paris came out, there were some dissenters, partly because the film had been so hyped. But it seems to have sort of settled into a kind of classic status now and is mentioned often in the book. Nicholas Roeg is another director who, even when his movies aren't terribly good, seems to have a really sensual feel for movie making. Don't Look Now is a film that's often referenced, particularly the sex scene between Julie Christie and Donald Sutherland, where they cut into the scene by them dressing afterwards at the same time, which is pretty amazing. And, you know, so I think there are directors like that who really have a grasp of how to turn an audience on in ways that aren't strictly exploitative.
Isn't it a miracle I didn't hurt myself when I fainted today?
No, unconscious body reacts faster than the mind ever can.
Perhaps.
Hmm?
You got toothpaste all over your mouth.
Eat it all.
A sensual scene between Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie in the film Don't Look Now, which, by the way, is about a couple whose child drowns, so again, perhaps not a Valentine's Day choice. We're talking about The X-List, a compilation of critics' favorite sensual films. Some other reviews, Michael Willington writes that the most sexually arousing scene for him is the first scene of Ingmar Bergman's angst-ridden masterpiece Persona. But other reviews don't immediately make sense. The Mummy?
Well, Charlie Taylor, who wrote that piece, was making the point that, you know, that The Mummy is sort of like the anti-Makioka sisters. It's a movie about ridding yourself of flesh or having flesh fall off you, flake off you. But I think there's a point to be made about horror films in general being on some level sensual, that the fright response is often, you know, part of the same response that we have when we're astonished by something that's beautiful or so ghastly that it opens our eyes.
That's Peter Rayner from the Christian Science Monitor. Joe Morgenstern from the Wall Street Journal, you wrote about a film that didn't quite do it for you, but what film does?
Well, I wrote about two films in the book, and the other one really did it for me, even though there's basically no sex in it. It's Trouble in Paradise, Ernst Lubitsch's comedy from 1932 with Herbert Marshall and Miriam Hopkins as two scam artists. But what the movie is really about is lovers getting off on the excitement of the scam as a surrogate for the excitement of sex. Not as a surrogate, as part of the excitement of sex, yeah.
You know, when I first saw you, I thought you were an American.
Thank you.
Someone from another world, so entirely different. Oh, one gets so tired of one's own class. Princes and counts and dukes and kings.
I'm looking at some of the other films, Y Tu Mama Tambien, Tarzan and His Mate, and my personal favorite, The Last of the Mohicans, 1992. I will find you.
Daniel Day-Lewis is one of the sexiest actors on the screen in that movie. It's an amazing performance.
Stay alive, no matter what occurs. I will find you. No matter how long it takes, no matter how far. We'll find you.
That's one great line. Peter, can you think of another that, you know...
Here's looking at you, kid. You know, I think it's not so much dirty talk as it is suggestive talk. Or no talk at all. You know, a look that actors give between each other. Hmm. Just about any look that Steve McQueen gave anybody.
And In the Mood for Love is one of the sexiest movies ever made, and there's no sex. It's a movie about yearning, and there's almost no dialogue that refers to sex except inferentially. Hmm. And yet there it is, this allure of the impossible.
Cue the music for In the Mood for Love. That's the 2000 Wong Kar-wai film. Now that's one you might want to see. No one gets murdered or burned at the stake. Joe Morgenstern is film critic for The Wall Street Journal. Peter Rayner is with the Christian Science Monitor. They're both contributors to The X-List, the National Society of Film Critics' guide to movies that turn us on. And by the way, for our listeners here in the Boston area, the Coolidge Corner Theater has been running a film series based on the book. Tonight they're screening Mulholland Drive. For more information on that or to see a list of the films we mentioned today, go to our website, here-now.org. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news.